And now on the space show, we're looking at the X-37B. Last week, we began to tell you about this space plane, which is operated by the United States Air Force. I was in Florida when it was launched. I saw it go up into the skies, and I saw it pass across Melbourne back here in Australia. And a wonderful sight passing across the sky like a moving star. And last week we began to play a press conference, but we only got up to about 6 minutes 47 into it and we had to finish. So we're going back to that press conference now, which was held just a few days before the launch of this wonderful space plane.
This flight's intent is the experiments themselves, both during ascent, during entry and on orbit. But there's no harm on this one.
Okay, BBC, Reuters.
Hi, Mr. Kinnear. This is Irene Fox. I was looking at your resume and reminding a little bit about all the past times a lot of us have probably run across the cap, and it seems a lot like memory lane for a reusable launch vehicle. I'm wondering if you might just talk a little bit about how you intend to not have this vehicle come to the same fate as all the others, and if there's also any plans to scale this up for any vehicle that might be useful in the civil space program as well. Thanks.
Well, clearly, I use the term piece part technology at the level of electromechanical actuators, and the flight control subsystems and the tiles. There could be application to other designs, to other vehicles. We chose this basic design back in the late 90s because it shares pretty much the same outer mold line as the space shuttle and a lot of the subsonic, supersonic, and hypersonic environments we could trace right from the shuttle to this design. So it's easy to rely on the shuttle's aerodynamic knowledge base for this particular design. And again, the piece part technologies, subsystem technologies, could be applied to any number of future systems. For instance, just lithium ion batteries. There's been a few cases where satellites have been designed and flown with lithium-ion batteries, but they are the newest sort of power storage technology that we're using in space. And so this, again, expands the knowledge base on lithium-ion batteries. So it's a wealth of different subsystems that could be applied to any design. And this first bird and the second bird will prove all those. Plus, again, the intent of X-33, X-34, and X-37 were really to see if new technologies could ease the turnaround between flights, lower the O&M costs, lower the cost of ownership for these kinds of reusable systems.
Florida Today.
Hi, this is Michelle Spencer. I have two questions. First, can you talk about the cost of this mission? And second, can you talk about any concerns you have regarding weather and how that may affect the mission?
Yeah, I can't talk about cost because I don't know the answer. And if you stretched all the way back to 1998, that would be because NASA spent money on it. Boeing spent their own research and development money on it. DARPA spent money on it, and then the Air Force took over. And so all those numbers, I have no idea what they add up to. Weather? Do we have somebody from the weather shop on board with us?
Blake.
45th Space Wing, are you there?
Yeah. Mr. Clay Flynn is here. He's a launch weather officer.
Okay, great.
Yes, sir. The weather does look good for launch Thursday evening, sir. It will have high pressure building in with fair skies. Winds are below liftoff constraints. We should have winds off the water from the east at 12 knots, gusting to 16, and just scattered sky conditions. So it looks pretty favorable for launch. So we'll just be watching for any development of cumulus clouds and looking for a 20% chance of violation or 80% of favorable conditions, sir.
Excellent. And I show, about a 1952 liftoff time. Is that right? Okay, good.
Michelle, this is Major Blair. Were you referring to the weather for the launch, or were you referring to weather impact on the system itself?
I was referring to the launch, but
okay.
If there's another answer.
No, that's okay. I just wanted to make sure that we were understanding your question clearly.
Yeah. Well, there is a good point there.
Okay.
And that gets to the operational nature of these kinds of systems. Early in the shuttle era, if the space shuttle was out on the pad 39, and a thunderstorm came through and rained on the shuttle, the tiles would absorb a huge amount of moisture, and that actually added weight to the launch. And the amount kind of surprised NASA early in its experience. These tiles that we have on this bird, plus the more modern tiles that the shuttle program has, doesn't allow that much absorption of moisture. Then again, also this bird will be inside a payload fairing for a multitude of reasons, so it won't be exposed to the weather conditions the way the shuttle is.
Okay. LA Times. Space.com.
Hey, Leonard, David here. I'm just curious on a couple of little points. Gary, you're talking about a turnaround time. What's your hope for a turnaround time? What would be the most advantageous for the project?
We used to talk a week for birds like the X-34 and such. And if we were in a surge environment where we were putting up a whole bunch of satellites all at once over the course of a month or two, kind of like in an operational responsive space scenario, if we were talking a surge of small satellites, I would like to see this X-37 handled much more like an airplane, maybe an SR-71, not an F-16, but an SR-71 probably, handled more like that than what we see with other space launch mechanisms, space launch vehicles. So again, I don't think we've set any specific goal, but I would think handling this bird more like an SR-71 and less like a routine space launch vehicle would be a good objective. And so that's measured in several days or maybe 10, 15 days or less, something like that.
Okay, and a quick follow-up on reentry. I mean, this thing, as far as I can tell, there's no control over it from the ground.
Right.
It's on its own. Do you have a go, no-go, what kind of abort capability you have if it somehow is not living up to the landing specs?
Yeah, there is. I've just talked. In fact, I talked to some range safety folks earlier today. Let me rephrase that. People with range safety experience. This bird, we will send commands to it to close up the solar array and the payload bay doors and all that, and then tell it to do a deorbit burn at a certain time. And then it's on autopilot, literally, the entire time, the rest of the way in. But it does have a range safety. We'll be tracking it over the Pacific, and it does have a destruct mechanism on it. I do not know the exact method for range destruct, but it does have a technique for range destruct during entry.
Okay. Wired.com. Air Force Magazine.
Hi, Mr. Payton. This is Michael Sirac with Air Force Magazine.
Hey, Michael.
Hi. You The Air Force and the DoD space community have two important events this week. One, X-37, but also the anticipated launch of the first hypersonic test vehicle, too. So I was hoping you would please kind of compare and contrast what you will learn with those missions, and specifically state if there's anything from X-37 that will help your knowledge base as far as prompt global strike, and is there anything from HTV-2 that will help your knowledge base as far as reusable space access?
Oh, yeah, good point. The HTV, as it's titled, is a hypersonic test vehicle. It's got a much, if you just look at the design of the two vehicles, the HTV has a much better hypersonic liftover drag than the X-37 or the shuttle have. And so that gives it a much better cross range at high altitudes and high Mach numbers. And so that's the dominant difference between the two. X-37 has different sort of a thermal protection system on the outside because the environment that it goes through is much different than what the HTV would go through. Both of them, again, getting back to things like flight control algorithms, getting to electromechanical actuators, those kinds of, again, subsystem technologies are probably valuable to share results with. But again, the shape of the vehicle itself is dramatically different because cross range is so important to the hypersonic test vehicle.
Thank you. A quick follow. Is there any chance that the second flight of this first X-37B vehicle could come before the first flight of the second X-37 vehicle that you said is planned roughly in 2011?
Yeah, the current plan is not to do that, and it's mostly to do with the on-orbit duration. We may be ready to launch the second tail number while the first one is still up in orbit, but we don't want to do that until we get the first bird on the ground, so that if we need to make changes to the second bird as a result of that first vehicle's entry, then we can still do that.
Thank you very much.
German Press Agency. Flight International.
Well, yeah, hi. Could I just understand how is the vehicle being operated, or where is it being operated from, and what level of operator involvement is there in the vehicle when it's on orbit?
Can you state your name, please?
Graham Warwick, Aviation Week.
We're going to control it on. We're going to get to orbit like any other Atlas or Delta payload. The rocket will be on its own guidance system all the way into orbit, and then deploy the X-37. And then ground controllers will control the X-37 just like any other satellite, monitoring the subsystems and telling it what to do. And then reentry activity is, again, pretty much, it's going to be significantly different than the shuttle because the real-time human control won't be there every single instant of deorbit preps and deorbit burn and then reentry. It'll rely again on its own autopilot, its own gyroscopes, its own GPS receivers, and eventually its own altimeter. I forgot if it uses a laser altimeter or a radar altimeter for landing. So it'll be on its own all the way through entry and landing, and that's dramatically different than the way the shuttle does it. But by and large, when it's on orbit, we'll fly it as if it was just another satellite.
Sorry, I jumped in there because I used to work for Flight International. My apologies.
Okay.
Okay. So Flight International, are you on?
Well, I'm his replacement.
Oh, okay.
Can you
Is this John?
John Croft.
Okay.
Flight International. Can you Can you talk a little bit about what I presume is a kick motor on the back of the vehicle, and what is new and different about the on-orbit attitude control algorithm that you're trying out?
It's just a regular, hydrazine propulsion system. So it's not anything new and different in that regard. Again, the flight controls are the electromechanical actuators that run the elevons and the rudders and such, and lower the landing gear instead of hydraulic subsystem. And then the autonomous algorithms for reentry. That's what's new and different.
And just to follow up, are you working anything toward on-orbit capture or on-orbit docking with other vehicles like the International Space Station?
No, we're not working on that.
Thank you.
CBS?
Yes, hi, Bill Harwood. Gary, you've been talking about the shuttle heritage in a sense. I'm just curious on your entry thought on the software and the controls entry. Can you tell us anything about the testing you've done to validate it, and what commonality it has, if any, with other existing systems, or was this developed from the ground up for you guys? Thanks.
Similar to the mid-70s, when NASA did the approach and landing test, there was a test article that we dropped from helicopter flights that did, the subsonic energy management aligned with the runway based on GPS signals, lower the landing gear at a certain altitude all by itself, and then hit the center, I shouldn't say hit, land on the center of the runway, and then apply braking. So all that was done autonomously on several helicopter flights, unpowered flights from helicopters. And that was, again, along the same mentality that NASA used back in the mid-70s with the shuttle Enterprise. Relative to the longer term, from the deorbit burn to this point where the bird turns subsonic, this program was started by the folks in Seal Beach who did the same development for the space shuttle. So it uses the same sort of energy management techniques that the shuttle uses.
Inside the Air Force? Fox News? Is there anyone else I haven't called on?
Yeah, Stephen Clark with State Flight Now.
Oh, I'm sorry, Stephen. Go ahead.
Gary is earlier with Mission Model Mystery and speculation surrounding this mission.
Stephen, can you speak up a little?
How's this?
Yeah, that's better.
All right, sorry. Earlier with Mission, the speculation, sort of the mystery surrounding this flight. I know that's nothing new for the military, but it does seem a little bit different this time. I was wondering if Gary could comment on that and be comfortable with that, or is that sort of cocooned out, and
focused
on operations?
Yeah, well, you can't hide a space launch, so at some point, extra security doesn't do you any good. So it doesn't bother me because, I grew up in the era when the Air Force and NASA were launching military things on the shuttle, and so I'm accustomed to keeping things secret. But the main thing we want to emphasize is the vehicle itself, not on this flight. The main thing we want to emphasize is the vehicle itself, not so much what's going on during the on orbit experimental phase, because the vehicle itself is the piece of news here. And again, if we can keep the O&M costs on these birds low, then we have a much more flexible space architecture, I think.
Yeah, I have one follow-up for you. Have there been any design changes since the Air Force got a hold of the program from DARPA and NASA, or really heavily based almost entirely on what NASA and Progress are building up.
Yeah, again, we wanted to capitalize on the work that NASA and DARPA did, both from predominantly from the aerodynamics perspective, and that was our main intent. This bird has been through all of the shake, rattle, and roll, the vibration tests, the acoustic tests that any spacecraft would go through, and so we were focused on keeping as much commonality with the prior work that NASA and DARPA had done, and keeping that, and then just assembling this vehicle and then sending it through the rigorous environments so that we'd have confidence that it would work.
You're listening.
There's a magic in the music.
Well, I don't know quite where that came from. Okay, we are listening to a briefing by Mr. Gary Payton, who is Undersecretary to the Air Force for Space Programs, at a media teleconference which was held on the 20th of April, just before the launch of this space plane. And coming up at 8 o'clock was Nick Black with Purple Haze. But first up, let's go back to that press conference.
Okay, is anyone else online that has not had a chance to ask a question?
This is Bruce Rolfson from Air Force Time.
Okay, go ahead, Bruce.
Wanted to ask Mr. Payton, where will the aircraft be controlled at? Where will your mission control will be? Which wing or organization the Air Force will be handling that? And also I wanted to ask, I know earlier you kind of discussed the cost, but what is the contracted cost for the model that's still due if that's considered public?
Yeah, I don't know. So it's part of our, it's all lumped in with our classified budget, and so I honestly don't know what the second tail number is predicted to cost. The flight will be managed by Air Force Space Command's 3rd Space Experimental Squadron, Blue Suiters, out of Space Command. Since this is a new experiment, we haven't established a standalone, unique ground control operation out in Colorado Springs. I suppose that might be on our agenda sometime in the future. So this organization called the 3rd Space Experimental Squadron is running the show for us.
Anyone else? Okay, we'll start back with AP.
I have no further questions.
Okay, Space News.
Sure, Gary. You were working on the FY12 budget build right now. Is it likely that we'll see a program of record next time around?
I think it'll still be inside our classified budget, so the people with the right clearances will see it, but not the media, unfortunately.
Thanks.
I mean, assuming the security system works right.
Yeah. Okay, I skipped Orlando Sentinel.
Thanks. Two questions. Wanted to see, will the X-37B have the ability to rendezvous with other craft in orbit, whether it be satellites? So this is one of the capabilities that you guys are looking to test. And at the same time, too, will it have the ability to operate autonomously in orbit?
We're right. It's, the on-orbit autonomy parallels our typical satellite operation. So, we send commands to it to do stuff, or we send timed commands to it to do something at a particular time. And so that's the way we handle all satellites. And this flight does not have any rendezvous and proxops objectives.
Okay. Christian Science Monitor? Reuters?
Yes, thank you.
I was just wondering what's involved in clearing airspace for this vehicle's return to California, and what information you're going to be releasing during the in-flight and landing phases of the mission.
I don't know of any planned press releases or anything for in-flight. And then it'll be handled with the FAA probably exactly the way NASA handles the shuttle return, because it will take it'll take pretty much, again, similar to the shuttle, it'll take half the world to come home, and the FAA will work with the FAA to clear the appropriate airspace, send out NOTAMs and such.
Are there any special concerns since it's an unmanned vehicle?
No, not really, not in my mind. Redundant flight control systems, redundant digital flight control systems have come a dramatic long way since the days of the early 70s when NASA was designing the space shuttle. If you fly in a 777 or a 787, you'll be flying on an airplane that's got redundant digital fly-by-wire flight control system, or in certain Airbus airplanes. And so the technology maturity for digital fly-by-wire has come a long way in the last 30 years after NASA's initial development. I've got a lot of confidence in the ability of this bird to come back home autonomously.
Florida Today. Space.com.
Yeah, hi, Leonard David here again. Just two little things. I'm curious about, you mentioned the tail number two. I mean, what's your druthers given some budget? Would you envision a fleet of these things beyond two? What number would you look at?
Oh, Leonard, that all depends on the success of these first two birds. Can we, is the O&M cost low? Can we turn them around between flights easily? Admittedly, these birds don't carry our biggest satellites like AEHF and SBIRS and all that. But again, they can do a very good job on our smaller satellites. And if they are low-cost O&M from an O&M perspective, they could be a big part of our future.
Okay, and just a quick follow-up on in-orbit capability. Do you have what kind of props on this thing? And I know you can get up to like 500 nautical miles, something like that. Is there any expectation to do some orbit maneuvering of this vehicle to different altitudes?
Just the way we handle satellites in general. Low Earth orbit weather satellites, we move them a little bit with their own onboard propulsion system. If I wanted, you're starting to touch on the notion of using a winged vehicle to really change the inclination of the orbit by sort of dipping into the top of the atmosphere and turning and then bouncing back up off the top of the atmosphere. That's, you need a very, very good, very, very high, again, hypersonic lift over drag in order for that to be beneficial. And this bird does not have that high hypersonic lift over drag ratio that you would need to do that kind of maneuver. Sorry, I didn't intend to give a lecture on Aero 562.
Okay. And the prop on board is what?
Just regular hydrazine.
All hydrazine. Okay,
next. Air Force Magazine.
Hi, Mr. Payton. Michael Sirak again. You talked before about how this could handle, I believe, small-sized satellites. In more layperson's terms, what does that mean? I mean, is the payload large enough to hold like a Volkswagen Beetle or an SUV? Can you give us some idea there?
Oh, well, you know our ORS program, Operation Responsive Space?
Yes.
Maybe a couple of satellites that are a few hundred kilograms each.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Aviation Week?
Can I just confirm something? You said that second vehicle maybe ready to launch before the first vehicle is back from its flight? This is not a short hop. This is a long endurance plan and a long endurance flight.
Right. We have a maximum of 270 days on orbit with this bird. And again, we don't want to launch the second one until the first one has had until we've learned everything we can from the first one. And so we will keep it on the we will keep the second one on the ground until the first one comes home. And yeah, so again, depending that maybe it won't be any more than 270 days. But again, it all depends on the progress of the on-orbit experiments. Then we'll make a conscious decision on the success of those on-orbit experiments before we bring it home.
Have you manifested the second vehicle launch yet? Or?
No, not yet. We set that's one of the things we're trying to get better at is the assignment of launch opportunities to individual payloads. And do that later, closer to launch than we currently do. But that's for all EELVs and Minotaurs and everything. That's not unique to X-37.
Flight International?
Yes, sir. One more. Given that the extent of going through this reusable vehicle, what type of interest is there in the Air Force in particular of bringing back payloads as opposed to dropping them off?
Well, yeah, the advantage of this vehicle is that you can take something up that's new. You haven't ever flown it before. It's new technology. And operate it on orbit, then bring it back and inspect it. In sort of a, kind of, what would you call that? Maybe a truck mode. You take it up and bring it back all in the same flight over the course of weeks or months. Shuttle has a limit of, I believe, 16 days on orbit. And this bird can go a lot longer than 16 days.
CBS?
No more questions. Thank you.
Okay, Space Flight Now?
No more questions. Thanks.
Air Force Times?
Hello again. Ask the Lieutenant Colonel there, down there at the Cape. How is launching this spacecraft different than your standard satellite launches as far as preparations, precautions? I was curious, for example, even if similar to the space shuttle, if you have to look at downrange landings since you have an aircraft that can't land, if there was some sort of emergency, if you could bring it down before it goes into orbit.
I would say that in general, it's very similar to processing other spacecraft. We do use a lot of the same facilities and processes for processing this particular vehicle compared to other typical spacecraft. What is unique is we have worked with the 30th Space Wing folks as well to work together. Launch sites as well as landing sites are available for the test flight. So we have been coordinating extensively with them. Typical launches, obviously, we're really limited to the eastern range on most other spacecraft. But in general, it's actually very similar, and I'll say that the processing for the vehicle went very smooth for a first reusable test vehicle, first time it's ever done. We've had no delays in processing. It's been a very good vehicle to work with.
Okay. Thank you. And also, is there any provision if there's some sort of malfunction and it can't get to orbit for it to land somewhere downrange?
No, I can't really comment on that. I don't know anything about that,
though. On the space show, we're listening to the pre-launch press conference for the X-37B space plane, the space plane that I saw being launched in Florida during April and which landed recently at Vandenberg Air Force Base.
For local news and views and the greatest variety of music, this is Southern FM 88.3.
And now we go back to Gary Payton and the press conference.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, I'm just going to go wired.com. Are you online yet? Or have you been online? LA Times? USA Today? German Press Agency? Okay, we've got about 5 minutes. Does anyone have any more follow-ups?
I do. This is Irene Cox with Reuters. So I was wondering if you might comment about the the Air Force and Space strategy and how that fits into the plan that President Obama's laid out for NASA.
Actually, this is Major Blair. For the interest of time here, this telecon is for X-37 launch, so if you'd like a comment on that, you can go ahead and email me and I can help you out with that, if you'd like a statement from Mr. Payton. So if anyone has follow-ons for the X-37 launch, go ahead.
This is Michael Sirek with Air Force Magazine again. Mr. Payton, what are the best adjectives to use to describe this mission? Is this something revolutionary, or how should we describe it?
Oh, wow. No, don't use "oh, wow." I don't know. I'm an engineer, not an English major. I would say that, again, if these technologies on the vehicle prove to be as good as we currently estimate, it will make our space launch, our access to space, more responsive, perhaps cheaper, and again push us in the vector toward being able to react to warfighter needs more quickly.
Okay, thank you.
Hi, Gary. Turner Brind again.
Hey, Turner.
Hi. Probably a dumb question. I guess I just don't really get the final intent of the mission you're looking for here, because an Atlas V launch cost $200 million or something, so I can't really figure out why you would want to take something up to orbit and test it and bring it down when you can kind of simulate all those things on the ground. The only thing that really makes sense to me is the ability to go up and get a spacecraft, maybe one that failed, bring it down, fix it, or see what went wrong, and put it back up there. Am I on the right track there?
Well, project a spacecraft or new technology that we haven't flown before, and we want to expose it to that space environment and test again, and then bring it back and inspect it. That's one of the big advantages this bird offers, and you get to expose that new technology for a long time on orbit. Again, not just a week or 2 weeks on orbit, but for a long time.
Hi, Leonard David here again with Space.com. Gary, I know you started out talking about your NASA days with X-33 and some of the other X vehicles. One of the things that never really quite showed up, and at least in my mind, in X-33 was the self-maintenance, self-health check. So when it got back down to the ground, you could really move along the turnaround times. Does this vehicle have that kind of self-inspection on landing? Can tell you how it feels?
Yeah, that's called vehicle health monitoring.
I can remember it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And some subsystems on this bird do have that, yeah.
So that's okay. And that's the first time this kind of hardware's flown, right?
Well, things like F-16s and 777s and those kind of birds have that.
Okay.
We've got time for one more question.
Yeah, it's Graham Morris, Shore Aviation Week.
And indeed, we have to leave it there. You've had 2 minutes left on this thing, but it's time to hand over in a few moments to Purple Haze. We were there at a press conference held just before the launch of the X-37B orbital test vehicle, which I saw being launched from the Cape Canaveral Air Force Station in April, and which landed recently, at the beginning of this month, at the Vandenberg Air Force Base, landed quite successfully. The next one of those will be launched next year, probably around about March, April sort of period, and we look forward to bringing you news about that on the space show. And Nick's a bit anxious to get away there. Now, if you want to see some pictures of the launch of that spacecraft, then you can go to our Florida Diary at the Space Show website on Southern FM. So go to the Southern FM website and then look for the Space Show page and then the Florida Diary, and there's a whole series of pictures there of that launch. Right, now, next week on the Space Show, we being sort of between Christmas and New Year, we have let our sort of socks down a bit, and we'll have a fair bit of music on the show, space music, of course, a few little short items, but a pretty light sort of show, but well worth listening to. As is Nick Black. He's coming up right now on the show.
There's a magic in the music through the day and nighttime too. You've a friend who play your music. We can bring it.
The best blend of music, community news and views. The Great Southern Sounds of Melbourne, 88.3 Southern FM.